Hello and welcome to the Whistleblower Newsroom. I'm Christina Borgeson here today with co-host Celia Farber. Today, we're thrilled to welcome Andrew McCarthy, author of the meticulously detailed and illuminating book, Ball of Collusion, The Plot to Rig an Election and Destroy a Presidency. The book reads like a razor-sharp prosecutor's case. No surprise there, since Mr. McCarthy led the successful prosecution of Sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman, also known as the Blind Sheikh, and his 11 cohorts responsible for the 1993 first World Trade Center bombing. He also contributed to the prosecutions of terrorists who bombed U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania. So he's a heavyweight, Celia. McCarthy has received the Justice Department's highest honors for his work. He has worked with as well as served as an attorney for Rudy Giuliani, who he credits with inspiring his career. He is a contributing editor to the National Review, a Fox News contributor, and a nationally renowned commentator on legal and national security issues. He's also a New York Times best-selling author, and his books include Willful Blindness, A Memoir of Jihad, and Faithless Execution, Building the Political Case for Obama's Impeachment. Welcome, Mr. McCarthy.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, I want to kick off this segment with a quote from your book. It's actually the last paragraph of your book describing what the ball of collusion is. And it's just absolutely sort of a laser beam description of the entire book, which, of course, we're going to ask you to unpack. You wrote, "That is the ball of collusion, counterintelligence as a pretext for a criminal investigation in search of a crime, a criminal investigation as a pretext for impeachment without an impeachable offense, an impeachment inquiry as a pretext for rendering the Donald Trump unreelectable, and all of it designed as a straitjacket around his presidency." And this is all ordered up by the president, by the former president, President Obama. And that's how you've described it. Is that correct?
I say that President Obama certainly was complicit in it, and it couldn't have happened unless he had greenlighted it, sure.
So could you, I mean, obviously, you know, could you give us sort of the brief highlight version of what you uncovered in this book?
Well, I think that what the book is about is putting in the service of a political campaign the intelligence and law enforcement apparatus of the government. And, you know, you can, I guess, on the point of collusion, which has been such a dominant topic in our political discussion for 3 years now or more,
right?
You could throw into the mix the fact that this putting the intelligence apparatus in the service of a political campaign had no small amount of contribution by foreign governments. I think, in fact, that I try to demonstrate in the book that I think it was mainly traceable to streams of intelligence that went back to 2015.
Yeah, you said British intelligence was mainly responsible, right? Was mainly involved.
Well, I think there, according to then CIA Director Brennan, they had streams of intelligence that were coming in from a number of not just Western, but at least one Eastern European allied intelligence service. And we don't know what they all are yet, but I think he's, my recollection is that he identified, besides the Brits, the French, the Germans, at least one Baltic state. We believe that the Italians are also involved. There's been, you know, recent reporting about the investigation of the investigators spending lots of time in Europe lately. So right. I think it was a number of different intelligence services. But I think the point is, and I hope the book makes this point, you know, I've said any number of times that if we really believed that an American political candidate was in cahoots with the Kremlin or any other foreign government, particularly a hostile foreign government, I think the incumbent administration would not only have the ability, they'd have the obligation to investigate that.
Right.
But we do have to recognize that for very good reasons, we have a norm in this country against the incumbent government putting its finger on the scale in a presidential election. And if they're going to conduct an investigation like that, they have to have a very, very good reason. And what I try to explore here is I don't see what the very, very good reason was.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the things that I found very interesting, was that you made it very clear that it's really not clear what triggered this investigation.
Right.
And I find that interesting, because if it's not clear what triggered it, then you have to consider in the mix that this was a sort of an attempt at a takedown, a political takedown, to ensure that Trump didn't make it to the presidency. You know?
I think yes, because they certainly didn't want him to make it to the presidency. But I think this thing really picked up steam more after he got elected than before. It clearly was going on before, but I think they had a very strong sense that Mrs. Clinton would win.
Yes,
and to the extent that that was a product of machinations of the government, I think that has to do with the very different way that the investigation of Mrs. Clinton was handled compared to the way the investigation of Donald Trump was handled. But you're right. I think the investigation that was premised on the foreign intelligence streams and picked up and run with by the FBI before the election, I think ultimately will be remembered more as a hamstring on Trump's administration than anything that was exploited in a very serious way to prevent him from being elected, because I think they just strongly thought Mrs. Clinton would win and there was no reason to have to do that.
So talk about the some of the strings, those initial strings. I mean, Papadopoulos was obviously, I think, one of the early elements of trying to look into this collusion situation. Am I correct in construing that that's what you were saying in your book?
Yeah, I think that there were other things that were underway before the Papadopoulos situation came up. We know, for example, that the big day in the Papadopoulos strand of the investigation is, I think, April 26th of 2016. That's when Papadopoulos meets with this very interesting character, Joseph Mifsud,
yeah,
in London, and they have this conversation. But before that, according to Brennan, they were getting information from foreign intelligence services about disturbing connections that Trump had with Russians and potentially Russian money going into his campaign. Those things went back to the latter half of 2015, although I think a number of the foreign intelligence services, according to the reporting, particularly in the British press, they thought the American intelligence services didn't take that very seriously until well into 2016. And we know that at the level of the Principals Committee in the Obama administration, they were conducting, I think FBI Director Comey discussed Manafort and Carter Page at a principals meeting. I don't have it in front of me now, but I can't. It's like February or March of 2016, and there was some thought even then of doing what they call a defensive briefing, that is going into the Trump campaign and telling them that they had a problem with potential foreign agents infiltrating. But the Papadopoulos thing really does become very important in the spring of 2016. And it's a story that, to me, when you look at it closely, has never made a lot of sense, particularly with this character, Mifsud, who flatly, by my old friend Jim Comey, who I served the U.S. Attorney's Office with many years ago, Comey, I think, flatly called Mifsud a Russian agent in a fairly recent Washington Post op-ed. I don't think there's any evidence that he's a Russian agent. Clearly, there's a lot of ambiguity around him in terms of what his connections were, and he has connections to Russians. There's no question about that. But he seems to be mainly an academic, and those who've looked at him closely, indications are his connections to British intelligence and Western intelligence services are at least as close as any connections that he has to Russians.
You know, go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to...
No. I just wanted to say, you know, we interviewed Papadopoulos on this show when his book came out. And I'll tell you something. I don't even think Papadopoulos realized what he had done and why he might have been targeted. But, you know, Papadopoulos wanted to be this foreign affairs advisor to the Trump campaign, right, and so on. And his big thing, because he's a Greek American, right, was he wanted to promote taking U.S. military assets out of Turkey and pivoting to Greece, which was a friendlier, warmer, friendlier country, and, you know, setting up bases and stuff there. And I told Papadopoulos, I said, and he was, you know, he worked at the Hudson Institute for a while, and he was sharing his brilliant proposal with Doug Feist. And I told him, right. I said, dude, I said, that's probably what put you on the radar for a takedown. I said, are you kidding me? Do you know how powerful the interests are, you know, from the Pentagon into, you know, powerful members of Congress, the State Department? Do you know how deep into Turkey this country is? I said, your suggestion of that pivot, I'll bet you Doug Feist made the phone call before you even left the building. And that's why I think Papadopoulos, all of a sudden, people were thinking, oh, my God, this guy is, you know, going to be a foreign affairs advisor. Oh, my God. You know, I think Papadopoulos, that's why he became a target. And of course, I mean, I think he just walked into it very, very naively. I mean, naive guy, you know?
Yeah, well, that's where you and I will definitely agree on that. I don't know that anyone took him terribly seriously, and as I say in the book, I don't really find him to be the most reliable source.
But his reliability is not what's germane. They were trying to use him. They were trying to use him, I think, as a way of getting him to implicate Trump as a colluder with Russia. He was an entry point. They saw him as an entry point, and they wanted to get rid of him too. So.
Yeah, well, I think that's fair enough. My point is, you have to look very hard at his version of events when you're trying to piece this all together. Because unspoken of events in this investigation that's really important is the fact that the FBI spoke with Mifsud. They never arrested him, but after they spoke to Papadopoulos, they interviewed Mifsud, and he denied the Papadopoulos version of events is that Mifsud shares with him that the Russians have thousands of emails of Hillary.
Right.
Right. They don't say DNC emails. They say emails of Hillary. And Papadopoulos is what he assumed was they were talking about the 33,000 emails that Mrs. Clinton hadn't turned into the State Department, which Trump was harping on the campaign trail. So that actually makes sense.
Right.
Because there's no evidence that these guys would have had any reason to know that Russian intelligence had the DNC's emails at that time. But the interesting thing is Mifsud is interviewed after Papadopoulos tells that to the Bureau, and Mifsud denies that it happened. He says that he didn't have any such conversation with Papadopoulos, that Papadopoulos must have misunderstood him. I've always thought that was pretty relevant, not only because Mifsud appears to have Western intelligence connections, and the government has never wanted to talk about Mifsud. But if there's one thing we know about Bob Mueller's investigation, it's that he knew how to bring a false statements case.
Well,
and
I mean,
they never charged Mifsud with false statements. They never tried to.
Well, I think you're making a. I'm just going to say this. I mean, I think you're making it quite an assumption there. About Mifsud's honesty. I mean, I think Mifsud was, I think, for example, what happened to Papadopoulos, hapless as he was, because that's the way I saw him. And again, yeah. when he talked about this famous proposal that I was like, no wonder. But anyway.
Let me just push back at that a little bit, because as I say in the book, we don't know that Mifsud is telling the truth. He could be lying.
Exactly.
The point is, there's a second version of events out there, and the version of events that they went with was Papadopoulos' version of events, but then they twisted that, because Papadopoulos has this meeting with the Australian diplomat, and both Papadopoulos and the diplomat say that Papadopoulos never mentioned emails. So we not only have a situation from the first conversation where it's not clear what emails were being spoken about, if emails were spoken about at all, which according to Mifsud they weren't, Papadopoulos says they were, then we have the second meeting where emails isn't mentioned. And the only reason I think that's relevant is the Downer, the Australian diplomat, waits over 2 months. And then when the DNC emails, the publication of them becomes public, he then says, oh, that must have been what George was talking about when we met 2.5 months ago. And then he tootles into the American embassy in London to tell them that Papadopoulos has told him, essentially, that the Russians had these emails that have now been hacked and put into the public domain. And when we trace back to the beginnings of the story, there was no reason on God's green earth to believe that Papadopoulos told that to Downer. There's no reason to think he knew about the DNC.
But that's exactly the point that I'm making, is that, you know,
yep.
First of all, he meets with Mifsud, and then, you know, all these other deep dark people, you know, with credentials, you know, official credentials, reach out to Papadopoulos and meet with him and talk to him and so on. And then next thing you know, the FBI nails him for lying, because
right.
what he said during a second interview doesn't match what he said during a
right.
first interview. And
ridiculous.
I have to tell you,
right.
we know, and you know, that's a classic way of getting somebody. You know, you.
Oh, yeah. Can I say, just to add to your point, I think it's actually worse than that, because Papadopoulos had counsel who had been cooperating with the FBI.
Right.
So they knew that he was represented. They could at any time have asked the lawyers, if they decided, you know, we think he's made a false statement, they could have called the lawyers up and said, bring him in, surrender him, we're going to charge him with false statements. Instead of doing that, instead of dealing with the lawyers with whom they had had dealings back and forth, they wait till he gets on a plane and leaves the country knowing he's going to come back. They wait till he's taking a night flight back when the court is closed, which yep. means to arrest him means they have to keep him a night in jail.
Exactly.
And they go out, they pop him as he comes off the plane, and they basically rock his world for a night and convey to the message to him in a what I think is a very intimidating, inappropriate way. This is what we can do to you if you don't want to play ball with us. And I think it's, you know, having done this for 20 years, to do that kind of stuff, you know, one of the things you learn when you're a prosecutor at the beginning is that you have an awful lot of power over people's lives. Enough.
Yep.
A junior prosecutor has enough power to ruin people and ruin businesses. And I think the more responsible people among us and the people that you want wielding that power are the people who have some respect for what they are doing to people's lives. And that didn't happen with Papadopoulos. What they did with him, I don't have a lot of sympathy for a lot of his version of events, but I think he was terribly wronged.
No,
I created him.
I just see somebody who was very who was naive, who was very ambitious, who came out with this idea that threatened a lot of established interests. And you know, he had the possibility of being a foreign, you know, affairs advisor to the next, you know, possible the next president. And, you know, so he got sucked into this thing and, you know, he got sucked into the buzzsaw. But the overall picture, and this is, I'd like you to talk about some of the details and the players. The overall picture to me is you've got the FBI and with Mueller heading this investigation. And I'm just looking at this. Understand, we on this show, I don't give a damn about left, right, politics. I'm not interested in that. I'm like, as you're a prosecutor, you want to know the evidence. You want to look at who's doing what to whom and, you know, try and figure out the picture. I see collusion from the, you know, just, first of all, starting with the president, the White House, okay? I see the collusion with, you know, the CIA, you know, Cy Hirsch actually in that telephone call where he was recorded unbeknownst to him, which really upset him. But anyway, he said, well, this was a Brennan operation from the get-go. That's what he called it. What do you think?
Well, I think that you have to recognize that if you're going to exploit certain powers of the government, there are officials who are in the approval pipeline, and certain things can't go forward without their green light on it. One of the things I think, you know, Brennan's role is not something that you have to deduce from, you know, the fact that they exploited certain intelligence authorities in order to pull off this investigation, because he's been fairly open in some of his testimony and some of his interviews about the fact that he acted as a clearinghouse through whom streams of foreign intelligence came in and passing that information along to the FBI, because the CIA can't operate domestically and it's up to the FBI to do things like get FISA warrants. I've also pointed out to people that, you know, I feel like every time I mention this distinction between criminal investigations and counterintelligence investigations, it makes people's eyes glaze over. But it really
is important. Talk about
because
that.
Because, yeah, counterintelligence is very different from criminal investigations are about vindicating the rule of law in court proceedings. And we don't want politics to be involved in determining who gets indicted and that sort of thing. And it's basically run with judicial oversight and a lot of congressional control, in the sense that prosecutors are limited to enforcing the laws that are enacted by Congress. So we want politics out of that. On the other hand, counterintelligence is done only for the president. It's not done for court proceedings. It's not done to build cases. It's done to gather information about foreign powers who may threaten American interests. The product that you get out of it is the sort of thing that goes into, for example, the president's daily briefing. This is something that's done solely for the president. And the president is necessarily in the pipeline of it. Now, we have reason to know because of some of the reporting and some of the texts between Strzok and Page and the like that President Obama had a limited amount of active participation in the Trump-Russia conspiracy in terms of approving it and giving some guidance on how it ought to go. But the fact that it was a counterintelligence investigation means that it was being done for the president, because there's no other reason to do a counterintelligence investigation.
Yeah, but what if you have a counterintelligence investigation that is politically motivated? Then what do you do? Because they're
you're not supposed to.
Well, exactly. But this one has the earmarks of that, does it not?
It does. But you know, here's what I would say about that, though. Let's say Trump really was a Kremlin plant, right?
Right.
How preposterous would it be if the FBI knew that and was doing a counterintelligence investigation to gather information about it, and the president didn't know? That would be really bad, you know? I mean, the president's supposed to know. The president, when the government has, when the FBI has a critical foreign intelligence investigation that involves a profound threat to the United States.
Yeah, but what we're talking here, it's so amorphous. What is it that they had that was really actionable, you know, for a counterintelligence?
I don't think they had it. Well, but let's remember, they don't have to have something actionable to do counterintelligence. Counterintelligence is information gathering. It's not triggered by probable cause of
crime. What I mean by actionable is what information did they receive what kind of information did they receive that raised the red flag and they said, oh, well, we need to do an operation to look into whether Trump is a, you know, a Russian puppet or whatever?
You're assuming something, Christina.
Well, that's what I'm asking. No, that's what I'm asking.
Yeah, but you're hitting the nail on the head, though. That's the issue here. So far, here's what we know. They had these streams of intelligence, which amorphous is a very good word for it, because, you know, Mueller did a 2-year investigation and said that there was no evidence of actionable, meaning criminal, collusion, no cyber espionage conspiracy and the like. So we have to think that whatever they thought they were getting from foreign intelligence services, it couldn't have been much of anything, because as I read the Mueller investigation, it doesn't look to me like they left stuff on the cutting room floor.
You know, we've seen this movie before. We have seen this movie before over and over. And, you know, I don't care if it's Trump or this one or that one, you know. We saw this movie during the run-up to the Iraq War. Now we see this movie. Now we see the Ukraine Gate movie. You know, the taxpayer is paying for all this stuff. And what is it exactly? What is it?
Yeah,
it feels like
a
political fight.
It's a great point.
You know?
Yeah, it's a great point. It's a great point, and it's largely why I got involved in this. I'm very interested in the politics of 2016, as we all are. I like American history, and I'm a buff for this kind of stuff. But what really lured me into the story and held my interest from the beginning is the fact that I used to be a prosecutor in terrorism cases for, you know, the last 8 or 10 years of my tenure as a federal prosecutor. And that experience taught me that unless we have viable counterintelligence powers, you can't protect the country from terrorist threats.
Andrew, you know, it's very interesting that you mention that. Because you will recall that the first World Trade Center bombing, you had an FBI informant, Mr. Imad Salem, who was in there. Exactly. Who was in there with the terrorists. Okay.
Right.
And then all of a sudden his FBI handler calls up and says, oh, we're removing you. And he's so freaked out about it because he knows these guys are going to do this job. He's so freaked out. He records his handler saying, oh, we don't have the budget, which we know is BS. We don't have the budget, this and that and the other. And they remove Imad. And then, of course, it's blown up. You know, the World Trade Center is blown up. And then they pay, I don't know, $1 million or whatever. I don't know how much money they paid Imad to come back and nail these guys. So, you know, I just find that when you're running these counterintelligence or you're looking into this or looking into that, things happen that shouldn't happen.
Yeah,
in a way that is so bizarre, you have to wonder why it happened.
Yes, tell us why.
Can I tell you why? There's a very good human nature reason why that's absolutely the case. And that is, and I can say this having worked both sides of the street, so to speak, when I did criminal investigations, I was allowed to go to a judge in secret to get warrants, you know, arrest warrants, search warrants, and the like. There was no one there for the other side. I could tell the judge, you know, whatever I chose to tell the judge under the circumstances. But there's a big difference. In a criminal investigation, everybody operates under the assumption that eventually there's going to be a prosecution and everything's going to be revealed. Everything's going to be turned over to the other side. Every representation I made to the judge is going to be known by the defense lawyers, who are going to have an incentive to pour over it to see if I was dishonest or if I did something that was against the rules. The fact that everybody knows that it's a transparent proceeding ultimately keeps everybody honest. You know, we always hope that we get honorable people in these jobs, but what keeps people honest is the fact that you know your work is going to be checked. And the problem with counterintelligence is your work never gets checked. The only due process an American gets, like the only due process that Carter Page got, was did the FISA court judge require the FBI to follow what on paper looked like very exacting rules for making sure you only give verifiable information to a judge in a FISA case. But if the judge does not apply rigor in that session and the FBI breaks the rules, you will never know about it. It's actually almost miraculous that we know about it in this case. But what I found again and again and again in a situation where I ended up using counterintelligence derived evidence, only because the guys who were in our case ended up committing a bombing and everything got flipped from the counterintelligence side to the criminal side. Now all of a sudden they didn't expect to have to make discovery, but now all of a sudden we have a criminal case and they have to make discovery. What I have unfortunately found over the years is every time you look under the hood a little bit, every time you get a little peek at counterintelligence, what you find is that you got people who don't think their work is ever going to be checked
by
a court.
What you find is corruption,
and they bend the rules.
You find corruption, and really, you know, just to bring this whole thing into focus, it looks. I read your book, okay. It looks for all the world to me, and I think it's starting to look that way to everybody else. That, you know, the Department of Justice, the FBI, the CIA, were all involved in trying to, first of all, cover up some of Hillary's transactions, her secrets. I mean, why would you let Hillary Clinton off the hook for having her own private server and having classified documents on her server and possibly Andrew Weiner's, not Andrew.
Anthony.
Anthony Weiner's computer. Why would you say, first of all, I don't even think intent in a case like that, intent even matters. The fact that it was done is what is illegal. She gets off the hook for that. She gets off the hook for Uranium One. And then all of a sudden this. It just seems like the ball of collusion is all in favor of protecting Hillary Clinton and her shenanigans, and then pivoting to Trump and trying to bring him down. Does that ring any bells for you, or am I spinning a story?
No. I think that I have take this for what it's for what you know grain of salt it's worth, because I do have I'm sure if you've read the book you know that it this is not easy for me, but I actually have affection for. Well, no, I like these people. I mean, I know Jim Comey for 30 years. I don't like writing, unkind things about him. But the fact of the matter is the Obama Justice Department was never, ever going to allow Hillary Clinton to be indicted. And what I think that what Honor would have called on Comey to do is do a full investigation and drop that in the lap of Loretta Lynch, the Attorney General, and let her decide not to charge for what was a political calculation, not a legal one. And instead, the FBI took the weight for that, and I don't, for the life of me, understand why they did that. But the fact is, it was rigged from the start. They were never, ever going to prosecute Mrs. Clinton. Not in that Justice Department, certainly not after the president not only endorsed her to succeed him, but also went on national television and said that he didn't think she'd committed a crime.
So this is the great mystery and pathology at the heart of this whole morass. Can we just stop there and talk about what you just said there? Why? I have a big, huge why. Why this extraordinary supernatural ring of protection around Hillary Clinton?
I don't know if it was about Hillary Clinton personally.
Right.
I think it was more about controlling the government. Obama was going to be gone. I mean, two terms, it was up. They wanted to continue to control the executive branch because it's very important to control the executive branch. There's a lot of, there are judicial appointments, there are bureaucratic appointments. Controlling the government's a big deal. And I think, Clinton was the person who emerged from the Democratic field.
She was going to do business as usual.
Say, yeah. I think a lot of us say it's amazing that we're in a country of 330 million people, who many of whom are gifted and brilliant and wonderful. And, those were the two people that we ended up with for the highest office in the country at the end. But it is what it is. And the Obama administration wanted Mrs. Clinton to win, and they put their thumb on the scale to get her to win.
Yeah, but
they couldn't overcome the fact that she was a very weak candidate, and they never took Trump seriously enough, which I can't say as I blame them much for, because I didn't take Trump very seriously through a lot of his through a lot of the campaign. So
I just want to tell our listeners,
everybody underestimated.
Sorry. Pardon? So I'm so sorry to interrupt. I just wanted to, if anybody, we have 20 minutes left on the show. Look, just tuning in now, we are listening to Andrew McCarthy, author of Ball of Collusion, The Plot to Rig an Election and Destroy.
A must-read book, by
a presidency.
The way. You must read
a must-read book. I wanted to read something actually from Amazon, if I could. And Mr. McCarthy, I'm so sorry. I derailed you there.
She so rudely interrupted you.
No, I made my point. Thank you.
Okay. Well, there's a fascinating, if I may, from the hundreds of five-star reviews on Amazon. Here's one. This is no Trump hagiography. It's a cold-eyed, detailed analysis by a top-flight former federal prosecutor of the story that has dominated the American political and media discussion for 3 years. Wonderfully well written. It is that rare expert account of a complex subject that is both comprehensive and clear. Highly recommended. And then there's another one.
Wait, before we get to another one, I just want to ask you something, because you were, you're obviously a highly skilled lawyer. You were at the Justice Department. This has got to bother you that politics trumps the rule of law. And the mixing of counterintelligence and criminal activity, sort of using counterintelligence to do what's not, what's legal, what's okay to do in counterintelligence, but you bring it over to the criminal side, you know, but you engage it, you use it to engage in what I think is criminal behavior. Am I wrong?
No, well, look, I think you've, this is the reason I wrote the book in the first place. One of the things that that drove me to stay involved in this and try to study this carefully is that I hate to be wrong. I hate to be wrong. And 2.5 years ago, I guess it's about that now, you know, friends of mine were saying, can you believe this? This Steele guy, who we later find out is actually working for an outfit that's been retained by the Clinton campaign through a cutout. But the story as it first began to emerge was that this British investigator, former intelligence agent, gave the FBI this opposition research information against Trump, a lot of which was sensational. And the FBI had run with the Justice Department to the FISA court, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, to get warrants on, it turns out to be, Carter Page.
Right.
And at the time when that story came out, I treated people who said that like they were the tinfoil hat crowd.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, you know, look, you don't understand how this works. What we're going to find out here is that the FBI didn't just, like, take a screed of opposition research and run to the FISA court. They went through it with a fine-tooth comb, picked out the 5 or 6 facts that they needed to make out probable cause that somebody was acting as a foreign intelligence agent, and they went to town on it like the FBI does, and they did an independent investigation. They talked to witnesses. They got records. They do what the FBI did. They did what the FBI always does, and by you're going to learn that by the time they got to the FISA court, no one would even have had to mention Steele's name or refer to him, because by then it will be an FBI investigation.
You were a true believer back then.
Well, not only that, I mean, look, I would tell people, and I still say this, you know, one of the things that gets people whipped up is that they took information from an opposition political campaign. And what I've tried to explain to people is, in my career, I took information from terrorists, from mafia murderers, from fraudsters, from, you know, the worst
of
the worst.
Those are the ones who know things.
Yeah, but the thing is, what you can take information from anybody. The thing is, the more suspect the source of the information, the higher your obligation is to corroborate it before you use it for anything important, and certainly before you go to a court. So I insisted to people that this would never happen. And, of course, it did happen. So I was like, galactically wrong on a basic thing.
Oh, I like so that, galactically what, wrong.
You know,
well, I mean, I was.
No, it's honest.
But you have to then say, so why did I get this so wrong? And I go back to the mid-1990s when we had the big to-do over the wall where, you know, the Justice Department interposes this set of restrictions that prevent the criminal justice side of the house from cooperating with the foreign counterintelligence side. And I was handling terrorism cases back then, and we took great umbrage at the wall because the Justice Department's theory was basically that we would lie to get warrants. That, you know, we would have cases where we would want to do a criminal investigation, but we wouldn't have enough evidence. So we would make up a foreign intelligence angle in order to exploit FISA, so that we could keep investigating someone until we finally came up with a crime, and then we would pounce. And I said back then, it's again, I'm wrong, it turns out, but what I said back then was, this can never happen, because if you assume a rogue, let's just assume you have an agent or a prosecutor who's going to act in a roguish way, it would be much easier to fabricate the grounds to do a normal criminal investigation, to get a normal criminal wiretap, than to fabricate a national security angle to get a FISA, because to get a foreign intelligence wiretap, you have to go through all these rungs of approval. So what did I get wrong? What I think it is I never accounted for the possibility that the supervisors who were there to make sure this kind of stuff never happened would take over an investigation.
We're in on it. Yep. Yep.
Right. And the thing is, every investigator, every good investigator becomes convinced that their bad guys are the worst bad guys in the history of bad guys. And you get a lot of incentive to push the envelope. It happens to everyone, and it doesn't matter how seasoned you are. You always end up thinking your case involves the worst bad people, and the rules are preventing justice from being done. And you need adult supervision there to say the rules are there for a good reason, and we don't break them. We don't take a screed of opposition research and run to the FISA court.
Well, I mean,
but the problem is, when the supervisors take over an investigation, they're just as susceptible as everyone else is to bad behavior, to bad incentives.
Well, actually,
but
when the supervisors take over, when the supervisors take over, you know that possibly bad behavior is going to happen, because usually it's often the case that supervisors take over when they don't want their underlings to be aware of some activity that they want to have that they want to engage in.
I want to pull back
I've never seen a case where that happened before, though. I mean, this is really extraordinary.
Well,
where
Can I say
something about Russian collusion? This is what I wanted to cite from Amazon, because I wrote a piece. I interviewed the Soviet dissident Vladimir Bukovsky, and in his book that came out within the last year, good heavens, how am I forgetting the title of this book? It was a 700-page book, and I read it, and I reviewed it. Vladimir Bukovsky. Okay, you'll pull that up for me. So this is all about the extraordinary depths and history of collusion with the Soviet Union in this country at every level of our political. So here's what I wanted to read from a reviewer said on Amazon. Of course, there was Russian collusion, says Andrew McCarthy. It's been going on for decades in both parties. He details how the late Senator Ted Kennedy went over to the old Soviet Union in 1984 and asked its leader, Yuri Andropov, to help the Democrats campaign against Reagan. I mean, I just have to pause there. Wow. He details how the Clintons shilled for Russian oligarchs who have, quote, donated tens of millions of dollars to the Clinton Foundation and directly paid Bill Clinton $500,000 for a half-hour speech at a bank in Moscow. So I just wanted to just kind of draw a circle around that, because we never talk about
that's the true history that context of, that historical context,
and
which,
suddenly there's this on the left, from the left, Russophobia, whatever to call it, and Russian it's so blood boilingly
in one headspin you could be lauded for being friends with the Russians, and then the worm turns up in a second, and all of a sudden you have to go to jail for colluding with the Russians. I mean,
could you address that for a moment, Mr. McCarthy, what I bring it up here?
I think we have to recognize, number one, that the Russians have been colluding in our politics. It's probably an overstatement to say that it goes back to the Bolshevik Revolution, but certainly since the Cold War decades, it's a fact of life. The other dirty little fact of life that people don't want to grapple with is that there's probably no government in the world that's more active in intruding in the politics of other countries than our government. Which is why I think that the idea here that in order to score cheap political points because they don't like Trump, by criminalizing something and scandalizing something that our country does and does for many good reasons and for many good national security reasons, they are making it much harder for our own intelligence people to operate in the world by doing this. But it simply is a fact that the Russians intrude in American affairs and American elections. Even President Obama said that it was something of a commonplace. after the election, that is, at least before they sort of latched onto this collusion narrative. Obama was pretty dismissive of what they had done and said, you know, this is what the Russians do, and he's quite right about that.
Correct.
And I think that if what had happened here was what was expected to happen, which is that if 75,000 or so votes in five counties and three states had gone the other way, and the press story on November 9th had been that a pillar of the political establishment comfortably won the election that everybody expected she would win, you would never have heard a word about Russian collusion.
Exactly.
You would never have heard a word about this narrative. We only heard about it because she lost.
Andrew, talk about Julian Assange for a minute. You actually called him a liar, I think. And I'm very interested in that. What is it that you feel that he has been dishonest about?
I don't know that I called him a liar. What I said is that there was a lot of there's a lot of evidence, and there's been a lot of reporting out of the intelligence community over the years that WikiLeaks or WikiLeaks, however they
WikiLeaks.
Pronounce it, WikiLeaks is a willing adjunct of Russian intelligence, that they have a working relationship. And I think that's been obscured over the years. WikiLeaks is very happy to expose American intelligence secrets. We don't ever see them exposing Russian intelligence.
But they have.
That's a valid point.
They have.
WikiLeaks has exposed Russian
intelligence. He's put out all kinds, like thousands of documents on Russia.
Is that right?
He
did have a show on RT.
Yeah. But still,
I'm not familiar with that, and I'll certainly
because
look into it now that you've raised it with me. But my point, the relevance of Assange to the ball of collusion is simply that if what they said was true, and there was this Trump Russia cyber espionage conspiracy that WikiLeaks was vital to. Then when Assange was arrested and charged, why on earth did they not charge him with collusion with Russia? What we've heard for 3 years is that Julian Assange was involved in a cyber espionage conspiracy with the Kremlin against the election. Well, you know, they have a chance to extradite him now. He's in British custody, right?
Yeah, but...
And when they filed charges, did they file a charge about collusion with Russia? No. They went all the way back to 2009, 2010 with the Manning incident. And as I try to argue in the book, that probably is not even a viable case for statute of limitations reasons. But they won't charge him with the other thing because they would have to prove that Russia is guilty.
Well, let me direct you to something that might help you. That might help answer that question. Are you aware of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity and the work that they did with the metadata?
I cite it in the book. Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So, and then, are you aware of this financial advisor Ed Pataske and how he? It's sort of like a Papadopoulos story. Got sucked into a situation that he is now. You know, he. This woman Ratner, this lawyer who met with Assange, and Assange told her that Seth Rich and his brother had given him DNC
Assange
documents.
Just said Seth Rich. Assange did not mention the brother.
Just said
it was the parents who mentioned the brother.
And he told this to this woman Ratner, and she called Ed Pataske, her friend, to say, "Look, I don't. He wants me to call the parents and tell them that they should know this, you know, because it might be germane to his murder." And Pataske was like, what? Why should I? But he finally did it because he felt badly for the parents. And the parents admitted to him that their sons, both of their sons, were involved in it. Seth and Aaron, I think, is the son's name. And Pataske came out with this. I mean, he was a commentator on Fox, and he was vilified and this and that. And now he's suing everybody who's coming after him for lying or whatever. and because he's, you know, he wants to protect his good name, and he says this is exactly what happened. And you have to ask yourself, you know, that's interesting that all that happened. There's nothing about that in the press. And why is it the FBI did not, why did they let CrowdStrike, that was, again, you know, the DNC hires CrowdStrike, why didn't they take the server and do their analysis of the contents of the server to see what happened? You know, I mean, there are a lot. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, first of all, that let me just tell you what my approach is, because I've heard, you know, a lot of the Seth Richard story is disturbing, and I've heard Patowski's.
The forensic evidence is what's really important, though. The forensic evidence is important.
All right. But I always try to stay with what I think you can comfortably say, even if it's not a popular thing to say. And I think what you can, the extent of what you can say that's relevant to what I was trying to establish, is that there's no way that the FBI and the Justice Department could prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the Russians were responsible for the hacking of the DNC. That doesn't mean they're not responsible. It just means that they could never, ever prove it in court. And I think that that was proved to a fare-thee-well when they had the opportunity to charge Assange with it, and they punted.
Well,
and the reason is, I think that they know that they can't prove it in court. And they were so desperate not to charge that they reached back to a 2009-2010 incident that they won't be able to even prosecute, I think, when you get to the end of the rainbow, because it's time-barred. Now, did the Russians do it or not? I think that's it's an interesting question. I've been willing, even though I worry that that we have a very politicized intelligence community and they had a powerful motive to blame it on the Russians, I've been willing to accept, for argument's sake, that the intelligence community's probably right and the Russians did it. That doesn't mean they did it.
Yeah, but why are you willing to accept? First of all, the intelligence community has shown itself on some of these major, major issues to be prevaricators, and, you know, period. And I really think that as a prosecutor and as an investigative journalist myself, I think both of us prefer forensic evidence. And that's why I was interested in what Bill Binney, you know, he was NSA's techno genius. Okay.
Yeah.
Other guy.
I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm saying this intelligence community is suspect, but the Russians do this kind of thing. So you can't. I don't think you can dismiss the possibility that.
I'm not dismissing the possibility. I'm just saying, if there's forensic evidence available before I even listen to what X says or Y says, let me look at the forensic evidence, and then the forensic evidence will point you to you know, the possible perpetrators.
We have 1 minute left. Mr. McCarthy, if you were telling this story to somebody who had no idea what any of us are talking about, how would you tell it?
I mean, minute. I'd first congratulate that person on his good mental health. I would say in all seriousness that I think it's an extremely important norm that we have and that has to be restored, that the powers that are reposed in the government for purposes of protecting our national security against particularly foreign threats are not used to interfere with American political processes or civil liberties. And that norm has to be restored. And secondly, because of my experience in counterterrorism, I don't think you could protect the country unless you have robust counterintelligence powers. And my fear is that when they get abused, as I believe they've been abused here, the public is going to demand that they be pared back, which is an understandable response. But I worry that we can't protect the country without them. So this is a major problem.
We've had really an amazing discussion today.
Fantastic.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Again, we've been talking to Andrew McCarthy. His book is Ball of Collusion, The Plot to Rig an Election and Destroy a Presidency. Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you, Andrew.